First things first, right at the top of the show, I just want to say a massive thank you. A huge, from the bottom of my heart, thank you, thank you, thank you to everyone who over the weekend and throughout this week purchased my new album. Now, that's what I call a bunch of Austin Archer's TikTok songs compiled into an album, Volume 2, on my Bandcamp. It just really means so much to me. It's so moving that people, A, want the music, that they enjoy it. I hope that it brings a smile to your face, whoever out there bought it. But thank you for going over there and supporting. The album's still available on my Bandcamp, austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com, along with all my other music. If you want to go and check it out, it's always a good day to buy from Bandcamp. Bandcamp has a fantastic profit share with artists. They give about 80 to 90% of their sales to the artists, and I donate a portion of all of my music sales to the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. So it's a good cause. You get to support indie artists. You get to support my music and my pursuits, and help out with that. And also, you get to support suicide prevention. So it's an all around good deal. But thanks to everyone. Thank you so much for everyone who already purchased. I hope you're enjoying it. It really means a lot. I was a very happy boy over the weekend. And just, it did my heart good to know that people were out there wanting to see this thing go on a little bit longer. Okay, that's all. Here's the show. I watched a video last night of a boat of people being evacuated from an area in Greece that was engulfed in flames. I wasn't sure what I was looking at initially. It looked like something out of a sci-fi horror film. The image was framed by the window of the deck of the ship these passengers were all on, hundreds of people staring terrified and dumbfounded at what appeared to be a giant demon wreathed in flame and magma slithering slowly across the glowing water. It honestly took me about 30 seconds to understand what I was looking at. First, I had to realize that what I was seeing wasn't some impressive CGI trick, that it was indeed real. And then I had to realize that it wasn't a giant fire monster, but was instead an entire island seething in a hopeless inferno. The movement of the boat was creating an illusion that the island was moving and pulsating, which created the feeling in my mind that I was looking at some kind of enormous living thing. I think it was just hard for my brain to comprehend an image like that, so I assumed it was something impossible and extraordinary, when in fact, what I was looking at was something that is becoming more and more ordinary with every passing year, month, week, day, and hour. Climate change and the disastrous effects that go along with it are very, very, very real. My guest today is an Academy Award nominated filmmaker and storyteller who has spent the last 15 years crafting stories and engaging in activism intended to call out and expose the fossil fuel industry and combat the global climate crisis. He believes that the fight against climate change is not one we should be afraid of or discouraged by. He believes it's not as hopeless as a fistfight with a giant fire monster. He believes that each of us can and should get involved in whatever way we can while there's still time. And perhaps that is the most hopeful belief that he offers. The notion that there is, in fact, still time. From a Blanketfort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking to filmmaker and activist Josh Fox about climate change.
I have to shout out. You start. You know how to. You start. I'm sorry. You go ahead.
Well, I'm just, you know, I don't do, there's some shows that, like, while the guest is on, they'll, like, do the intro and you get to hear it. And I think that maybe I should do that because sometimes I'll guest on other people's podcasts and they'll do the intro while I'm there. And they'll be like, my guest today is A. And they'll, like, list off all this stuff. And, like, I get to sit there and, like, hear them say all these nice things about me. And then we start talking. And then my
my ego's all inflated, and I'm like, wow, they really did their homework. But I do like my intro on my guest when they're not here, and I like record.
That's fine.
It.
That's, so I don't need any ego boost this morning. It's fine.
I just jump into talking to people like, yeah, whatever. I don't really care. I don't. Yeah, you're just some person that I met on the internet, and like you do stuff, right? Like
I do stuff. I've done some stuff. I got your video because that one viral video was so fucking brilliant and hilarious and amazing and beautiful and also just catchy. Came to me because I was writing to a friend of mine about something entirely different, and then she sent me that video. Her name is Jasmine Neosh, and she's out in Wisconsin, and I'm shouting her out.
Oh, cool.
And she sent it to me, but she was like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to send that to you. And I was like, ah, no, I must look. You know. And then it was like the funniest thing I've ever seen, so I sent it to like 100 people. And that's the way those things go, right? But so I just wanted to say thanks to Jasmine for putting us in this conversation today.
Thank you, Jasmine. And for real, you are actually kind of a fancy pants guest. Typically, yeah, I'm having people on that like I either was friends with in college or friends in high school or like family members. And that's not that to say that they're not important people or special people. But you know, and sometimes I get to talk to people who are doctors or people in interesting circumstances. But you've done some really, really cool things in your life.
I would love to have gone to high school with you. I don't know where you went to high school or college. We can always just lie.
Yeah. Yeah. We can always say that like,
where did you go to high school?
I'm from Utah. Where are you from?
From Utah. Where in Utah?
Salt Lake area. So I'm from a suburb called Sandy. That's about 25 minutes south of Salt Lake City.
It is pretty sandy out there.
Yeah. You know, there's
not the most original name.
there's the dunes and the flats and
dunes are, well, yeah. No, I'm actually from a number of places. I'm from New York City, but I'm also from the woods of Pennsylvania, which is where I am right now.
Oh.
I have multiple origin stories. Right now I live in between several places, and I move around a lot doing movies and stuff.
Right.
But right now I'm in the woods of Pennsylvania, Northeast Pennsylvania, the Delaware River Basin, which is, a very important place for me and my films. Certainly the place that we fought the oil industry and brought, and banned fracking that was supposed to happen all over here in this beautiful watershed area, mm-hmm. which supplies water to 16 million people in New York City and Southern New Jersey and Philadelphia. So it was a big, long fight that the oil industry wanted to take this place, destroy everything, and we stopped them. And that's, I think, in a way, my claim to fame these days is having made that film called Gasland, which is about fracking and breaking the fracking story worldwide. So that's where I am right now.
Was that kind of the first time that people started seeing footage of people like lighting their water on fire as it's coming out of their?
Oh yeah, comes directly out of that film. That's the famous shot scene around the world is where Mike Markham in Colorado and Amy Ellsworth, also in Colorado, who are in the, where they call it the red zone. They're surrounded by fracking gas wells and they light their water on fire. And it's a very insane scene. It's also weirdly funny. And that clip, I mean, the film was seen all over the world. It was seen in 32 countries. It was on HBO.
It's an Academy Award nominated film.
Nominated for the Oscar and won an Emmy and all the stuff. Anyway, which is great. But the point of the film was always to stop the industry, stop fracking.
Yes.
To try to ban it as many places as we could ban it. And we've had some success. I wouldn't say we've had the success that we wanted. I mean, we did save the Delaware River Basin. We did stop fracking from happening here. We banned fracking in the state of New York. We banned fracking in France, in Scotland, in Ireland, in Italy, in Germany, in 12 or 15 countries in Europe. We banned fracking in many, many states. And the industry is now being really pushed into a corner. But for the last 10 years, we've seen fracking and frack gas take over our entire energy spectrum. The Obama administration was very pro-fracking. The Biden administration is very pro-fracking. And we're seeing a lot of extraordinary adverse impacts because of pursuing that policy, both on the climate front in terms of also environmental degradation, people getting cancer, people getting very ill in the places where they're doing it. So we won a lot of things, but I don't know that we are winning in the larger sense. We have a lot to go.
Ah, that sucks. And
it fucking sucks.
Yeah,
it really sucks.
Yeah.
But I mean, so it's like a mixed bag, you know. Like in one sense, we save some extraordinary places. But if we don't get wise, we're not going to save the most extraordinary place, which is the planet Earth, and that's very serious.
I saw something recently that someone was like, "Hey, you know, like it was like a meme, and someone was like standing with Mother Earth and was like, I'm so sorry that we're killing you. And Mother Earth was like, oh no, I'm going to be fine. She's like, I was here before you were here. She's like, I'm going to be just fine. You guys are going to fucking die.
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, there is a fundamental partnership that needs to happen between people and nature. If that balance gets out of whack, then the planet tends to eliminate the thing that's out of balance, right? Mm. And we are smart enough as a species to be able to understand the way the planet works, you know? And we could be living in cooperation with it, as many people on the planet have done for thousands and thousands of years, right?
Yeah.
The inhabitants of this continent, the North American continent, you know, lived here for 10,000 years and did fairly well in terms of being a cooperation between the landscape and humans. Mm-hmm. Western civilization and the colonialists have come across with this idea that humans are somehow separate from nature. Humans have dominion over nature.
Yeah.
Humans are allowed to do anything in nature that we want. Well, it's true that human beings garden and human beings, plant things and create civilizations.
We terraform.
But if those things are not in a participation with nature, if those things are just about the principle of how much money you can make or how exploitative you can be, then yes, those things tend to collapse. And we're facing that right now. If we don't figure out how to stop the insanity of, you know, everything being based on how much money you can make, we're going to die. The whole species, and probably take a whole lot of other species with us, which is what's very, very scary.
Yeah, it's not.
Out of all the 10, 12 years or whatever I've been doing this on, working on the environment, that's the basic principle. You know, if we decide that everything is about money, we're screwed. If we create a different principle, which is to say we want a quality life, not just for us, but everything else on the planet, then that will rearrange our priorities, right? So for example, even I was talking to a friend of mine about solar development yesterday.
Yeah.
And the solar developers are the good guys, right? We want solar. We want non-carbon, non-fossil fuel based energy. We want solar and wind, right? But if it's a capitalist, mega capitalist solar company, what they're going to do is going to be like, well, we're going to clear cut 2 miles worth of forest and put the solar farm there, and that'll be the most efficient and it'll make us the most money. Even in the sense of a solar development, that can't be the principle.
Right? Yeah.
The principle has to be, what's the best way we can ensure the quality of life for everyone in that area, and then as a consequence, everything else. So if you were to come back with that, you'd say, oh, well, let's solarize every parking lot and every rooftop first. Mm-hmm. And it might cost a little more, or let's say it won't cost a little more, might make less money for the people involved, but it will make a quality of life for everybody. If we decided that that was our principle, we would also understand that built into that principle is a cooperation and a planning with ecosystems that keep everything moving forward, which is nature, right?
But since
that simple,
capitalism exists, and since the only thing we really expect and respect, and the only principle that we are actually after is how can we make the most capital and generate the most money, we don't move forward with plans that make less or maybe cost more but are more in line with being in cooperation with the existing environment there.
I also think that this is true, though, in other societies that are not capitalist. It also happens in socialist societies and communist societies.
Why do you think it happens
there? If you look at China, China is trying to develop as rapidly as possible. And the idea is development. Development equals also riches and a hierarchy and money. Mm-hmm. If you know, so that's not necessarily a capitalist notion in the sense that people are accruing capital and it's happening in an individual way. And there's a quote unquote free market, which of course is not free at all. But the idea that that we're not organizing quality of life as the top principle for everyone. We are still participating in hierarchies. We're still participating in essentially the accumulation of wealth, which, you know, can happen in that's definitely happening in China.
Right? So regardless of whether or not it's
happening in the third world, and this definitely happening in others, it has historically happened in societies that were not capitalist in the same way that we define ourselves. I think it's a weird thing because we often think about economic systems as our way of defining the whole place. But if we don't define it in terms of like capitalism, communism, we say this is extractivism, or this is about economic inequality versus economic equality, or this is about creating wealth and opulence at the more than it is about respecting a balance and giving people basic needs. I think those are the things that I'm trying to figure out different words for, but they're it may be futile. I don't know that there are different words for it.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Okay. I mean, yeah. So there's these different governmental systems or different societal ideologies. But at the end of the day, hierarchical frameworks in any shape or form are going to sort of breed this kind of extractivism that you're talking about, or like anything that is a society built around that sort of funnels up towards this top where there's a very few people at the top who are trying to maintain their grip on power and control and trying to grow that, whatever they call it, whatever governmental system it is, or societal ideology it is, if it's socialism or communism or whatever, if it's hierarchical in nature and it involves a minority of people at the top trying to retain control, it's probably going to feature heavily some form of environmental, you know.
I would suggest that if we look at the value structure that's happening inside mm-hmm. of any of those systems, right? Like our system in America, the values are greed, racism, violence, incarceration, competition.
Yeah.
We are discovering that maybe those weren't the best principles to base a society off of. You know what I mean? Like, I made a film called How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. And it's about how climate change is coming for us. And there are certain things that we're not going to be able to fix mm-hmm. in time, right? We can see this summer is the summer where people are really going, holy shit.
Yeah.
It hasn't stopped raining on the East Coast for the entire summer. And on the West Coast, it's like everything is on fire. And people are going, oh, wow. This summer is sort of redefining what we thought climate extremes were. We're seeing things this summer that they weren't predicting to happen for another 80 years, right? Yeah. It's like, it's crazy. Plus the pandemic, which is also exacerbated by climate and fossil fuels. But that's another subject. But what I guess I'm saying is that, like, in that movie, How to Let Go of the World and Love All Things Climate Can't Change, the things that climate can't change are our values. Like, I hope, right? Like, it can't, courage, innovation, equality, peace, you know, some of the basic things that we might invest in, democracy, civil disobedience, human rights. Hopefully climate change can't change those things, right?
Yeah.
Those are the values that we might want to invest in. And I do think that there are societies that have those principles. I mean, obviously, I think there's good things about American values. There are great things about American values. Democracy, representative democracy, is an American thing. Mm-hmm. Originally coming from Native Americans, but you know, the idea that we are right now in the grips of a system that is based on the things that I just mentioned, and that to me has to change. And we have to. I don't know if it's Pollyannish or naive to think that we could focus on values. And I, because values also is a very loaded word, family values, Christian values, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, I think right now we are in the economic system definitely has to change because we are allowing people like Jeff Bezos to exist. It just should not. This should not be, you know, billionaires should not be able to go into space before everyone, you know, has healthcare.
Yeah, it's just, it's just insane. It's absolute insanity. I want to keep talking about this and talking about, you know, what's it going to take and what are the things that it's going to take for us to start making some of these changes maybe and some of these value changes. But before we do, I just want to move backwards briefly and just really quickly spend some time qualifying you to my audience. Like, could you just give us a scope of some of the work that you've been doing over the last, you know, 10 to 15 years, you know, as a filmmaker and just as a climate activist and stuff? And what kind of comes first? Is it sort of, are you involved in climate activism and that leads to filmmaking, or is it vice versa where you're a filmmaker who finds this thing and it becomes kind of a calling, or do they work in tandem? Uh-huh.
Well, okay, so I've actually been in theater or in film my whole life. I started, I guess, as an actor when I was around 11. And so I've been in theater since I was a kid. And I even when I was a young person, I found that the great plays, Shakespeare, the Greeks, Arthur Miller, Bertolt Brecht, these were all plays that were very intensely political.
Yeah.
And that you can't have a great play, certainly not a great drama, without it being expressly about the politics of its time. Hamlet was about the politics of its time. Mm-hmm. You know, so was the Oresteia of Aeschylus, which I was just thinking about, so which I was in as a 14-year-old. So was All My Sons by Arthur Miller. These things are about justice. And so when I became making my own theater company, which I started in 1996 in Thailand, as a very young person with a group of other very, very young people from Thailand. The company is called International Wow Company. Internationalwow.com is our website for the theater company. We started making plays in the late 90s as a sort of cultural Esperanto, like all these kids who grew up on MTV and, you know, had a similar pop culture language, but also had very, very, very different backgrounds economically, culturally, whatever. People from New York and then Canada and, you know, Australia and Thailand, Philippines, Japan, Taiwan, coming together to make these huge plays, epic plays. And what I would do as the director was I would interview the actors, and the actors would tell me things about their lives. And those stories were invariably about a political matrix or an economic matrix or a cultural matrix that we were now on different sides of. And we would create these giant plays that were sometimes 3 and 4 hours long about
awesome
big global issues, right?
Yeah.
And they became quite popular in Asia and then in New York City. And we were the first company to address 9/11 from the standpoint of people who went through it. I was a person who worked in the World Trade Center as a gardener. I would go in and replace the plants next to all the Wall Street traders who were screaming into phones and killing their plants. So we made a play called The Bomb, which was about nuclear war and American intervention, and also about sexual awakenings and non-monogamy. All these things sort of crammed together in this giant world-spanning play with actors from 12 different countries. And that was a very big hit in New York. And so what I learned was that when you're making plays and films, there is a crisis that is happening on the sort of personal level, the emotional level, right? Like we have a story. A story is a crisis, right?
Yeah.
It's a crisis that needs to get resolved. And that's what's happening in like a love story. That's what's happening in a story about, you know, political achievement and sports, whatever. Mm-hmm. But then there's the much greater, that's the 3 feet. And then there's the 30,000 feet. The 30,000 feet is, where are we? What's happening? What is America's role in the world? What is, you know, why did 9/11 happen? And then we became totally obsessed with making films and plays about the Iraq War.
Yeah.
Because we felt as New Yorkers that we had some degree of responsibility for speaking out against wars that were being committed in our names, right? Mm-hmm. In of 9/11. And we felt that 9/11 had been taken away from us as New Yorkers, that it was used by George Bush and by the mass media as a justification for killing people in other countries, which we were against because we were an international theater company, right?
Sure,
like,
yeah.
We're going to bomb our members of our other, you know, we had members of our company from Indonesia, from Palestine, from Pakistan. You know, we were not going to align in that way. So the idea of international WOW company was several things. WOW being like a thing that you feel immediately when you get off a plane in another country, like, whoa, you get that international WOW.
Yeah.
And then WOW being a word that people use all over the world as a kind of a word that exists in so many different languages. So our mission as an international theater company was sort of like, in a way, an anti-national theater company.
Yeah.
The idea that nationalism is an ideology that forces people to fight with each other. And we wanted to start to pick that apart. So our focus, my focus as an artist, was making plays that were going to reflect the political crisis of our time, but also personal crises, those personal stories, the 3 feet and the 30,000 feet. And then in 2008, here in PA, at my family's house in the woods, the natural gas industry knocked on my door and asked us if we wanted to lease our land for fracking. I was extremely suspicious of this and very worried about it. And I'd seen pictures of despoiled landscapes in Pennsylvania and in Wyoming and moonscapes that had been raped by oil drilling and rainbow colors running in toxic streams off of people's water wells in Pennsylvania. And I was just horrified. And I just said, you know what? I want to help as a storyteller. And I started to make what I thought was going to be like a short film, a little YouTube thing on this thing that nobody had ever heard of called fracking.
Yeah.
And the story got quite deeper. It took me all over the country to 25 states. And I made that film Gasland for about, I was driving all over the country. I had a camera already, for about $2,500 was the first initial shoot budget. It was ridiculously cheap. I was camping out. I was sleeping on people's couches. I slept in the back of the car and I shot for 30 days, 30 out of 31 days. And I came back with the bulk of the film. All these people whose water had been poisoned, who are suffering health problems, who could light their water on fire, right? Yeah. In Colorado and Wyoming and Texas, and Arkansas and PA and all across the country. And then came back and compiled it with a brilliant editor, Matt Sanchez. And that got into Sundance Film Festival, won the Special Jury Prize, won the Critics Poll, got picked up by HBO, seen in 32 countries worldwide to an estimated audience of 50 million people, and started this movement, or not started, but galvanized the movement on fracking. And then, of course, went to the Oscars and all these awards, but really then put me in the hot seat as public enemy number one of the oil and gas industry for 6 years, a position that's pretty probably occupied by Greta Thunberg at this point. And all the pressure that came. And then, of course, we made Gasland Part 2 on HBO, and then the film How to Let Go of the World also on HBO. And then Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock was a collaboration film that I made with Native American filmmakers at Standing Rock and the uprising against the Dakota Access Pipeline and the oil companies there. So that's defined my work for the last many years. And then I made a one-man show called The Truth Has Changed, which is about smear and misinformation campaigns, starting with the ones directed at me and then the ones directed at the entire American public during the 2016 presidential race. A bunch of new films and projects coming out right now. But so the idea that politics is somehow divorceable from art is silly to me. It's like when you do your video.
Yes.
When you're like, this guy's like, doesn't want to learn what pronouns are. Yeah. I'm like, to me, it's like, how do you divorce the political from every day? It's like you can't extract it.
I love hearing that, because people all the time in my comments will there will always be that commenter that's like, why do you have to get political? Can't you just make the sketches? Right. Like, I like the sketches. I like the funny ones. Why do you have to get political? I'm like, first of all, welcome to my account. Like, I don't know if you're new here, but like, this is something we do here. And second of all, like, I say this often. I'm like, I don't, This stuff is only political, quote unquote, because there is opposition to some of these ideas. There is political force opposing these ideas. It makes it necessarily political. I don't think asking people to wear masks in a global pandemic should be a political thing, but it is. So many things that shouldn't be political, that should be common sense, that should be just based on basic human compassion, become political. And I like you saying that you cannot, in current modern society, divorce politics from our discourse. Like, it just, you just can't. Like,
it's always it's always the people who are benefiting from the political situation who don't think of it as political, right?
Right.
Or it's the people who are politicizing the situation, right? Like,
who want to not talk politics. Like, I don't want to. Right. Why do we have to talk politics? Like, it's all politics.
Well, because they don't have to think about politics because the political system supports them, right? Yeah. Like, I had this conversation with a person that I should remain nameless about, like, why are you making the virus political? I was begging them to get vaccinated.
Yeah.
Or this virus is too political, and I'm a conservative, and I don't like the fact that it's being made political. And I'm like, okay, wait a minute, hold on a second. It's not us,
right,
that's making science political. We're sitting talking about science. I mean, like, progressives are talking about the science of climate change. We're talking about the science of fracking chemicals going into the ground and despoiling your water. We're talking about the science of vaccines. We're talking about the science of how coronavirus spreads. Like,
yeah.
You are opposing science and you're making it political. We're not. We're saying these are the common sense scientific things. Our entire civilization, everybody's lives that we know of is based on science, right? And it's funny that this conversation is happening over email, right? It's not happening over smoke signals. Like, oh, smoke signals is kind of science also. I mean, it's not happening over, like, you know, like somehow, like, this entire conversation that we're having is technology dependent.
Yeah.
And yet you cannot acknowledge that actually the science of email is younger than the science of mRNA vaccine technology, which has been trying to be developed for 40 years, right? So, like, the idea that somehow, like, these people are saying, well, don't make it political. Well, what you're basically saying is, don't make me aware of the privilege that I have because of this political system. Don't make me aware that I am at an advantage opposed to other people in this political system. Don't make me feel like I am a bad person. But the truth of the matter is like, if you are not working for equality, if you're not working for the betterment of other people, you are a bad person. You are a beneficiary of a political system,
right,
that is excluding other people. And if you are, and historically excluding huge amounts of people, and if you're not actually paying attention to that, then in fact, you are siding with ExxonMobil on climate change. You're siding with George Bush on the Iraq War. You're siding with Donald Trump on injecting bleach into your body instead of wearing a mask or doing a vaccine.
You're siding with,
you are not taking action to, if you're not taking action to address injustice, then you are part of the injustice.
Yeah, the expectation, you hear this all the time with sports, where it's like, I hate when athletes have to get political. I'm just trying to be entertained. I just want to watch the basketball game. Why? It's like, you expect these guys, you expect a league that is majority black in America to not address the fact that on camera, cops are routinely murdering people and no one's being held accountable for it. And again, how is this a political issue? Like, you watched the video. Did you see the video where the guy killed the other guy and we all watched the video? Like, I don't care who you vote for. We should all be in agreement that that person was not doing their job properly and not only needs to lose their job, but needs to go to prison, like, for the crime that they committed that we all watched. It's not political. It's not politics, but it's only political because there are people opposing this idea, opposing this common sense.
But in a way, though, it is. But to me, I think it does come down to who you voted for, because there are people who you vote for.
Yeah.
Who? Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, voting is such a, we have so few choices when it comes to voting, which is in and of itself a political problem. But the idea that politics is simply the notion that many people should control the power. Political power is, poly meaning the masses, the many people. Mm-hmm. How do people control power? How does power work? So what you're saying is, like, when you're saying, I don't want to be political, you are saying, I don't want you to address the power structure.
Yeah, yes.
And therefore, because, and the only people who ever say that are the beneficiaries of the power structure.
Yes.
It's never the people who are not the beneficiaries of the power structure, right? It's never the people who are being murdered or being oppressed or being discriminated against or being threatened with violence that are saying, oh, well, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to address the political structure. I don't want to address the power structure, which is currently beating me in the face because I'm gay, which is currently, you know, making me feel terrible because I'm trans, which is currently prohibiting me from being in school, you know, safely because I'm black. You know,
well, and you can,
those are people who are very, very happy to address the power.
You can find those people. You can find the Candace Owenses and Milo Yiannopouloses, people who have been made to feel like, we will let you be on our team if you convince everyone to shut up and stop talking about the
power
structure.
But they are also not disempowered. Those people are empowered by doing that.
Yes.
Right? Uh-huh. And don't forget, that's historically how people become a part of the power structure, right? Like, like if we're talking about the power structure, we also have to talk about white supremacy. And traditionally over centuries, that is how disadvantaged groups became white people. 100 years ago, Italians were not white people. Irish people were not white people. Jews were not white people. Jews are still not really white people, but we're not going to talk about that. But how you become white people is you decide that you're going to embrace that structure of power and you're going to support it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I see that happening. Or the appeal of that happening with somebody like Candace Owens or some, rather than say, we don't want a structure of white supremacy. We don't want a power structure that's based on that. Those people are saying, I embrace it and I join it and I support it.
Yeah.
Which is different than, I mean, because the power is not based on their race. It's based on, in many ways it is. But they are saying, we're going to support that structure because now I benefit from it.
Yeah.
So they are the beneficiaries just as much. But if you are saying, no, actually, we should not have a system based on that, based on white supremacy, colonialism, and historical exclusion, then you're on the out, whether you're a white person or not. Right. Whether you're a black person or not, I mean, you are potentially in deep trouble. And I think that, you know, it's one of those very, very deep questions that we talk about when we talk about whether race is a race being a construct.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a person who is me, my father's Jewish, a victim of the Holocaust, a survivor of the Holocaust, a person who grew up very much understanding the horrors of white supremacy, the horrors of racism. Racism enters the English language during that time of Hitler. So racism against Jews. Well, back in those days, Jews were certainly not white people or whatever. They were Aryan, right?
Yeah.
And in America, Jews sort of are. So it's a very, very odd thing to sort of look throughout the last bunch of years and go, this is a movable feast. Racism is and race is constantly shifting. So I choose to look at the system of white supremacy and go, well, everyone suffers from this. Everyone, not just people of color. Obviously, white people suffer from it to a great degree because it allows the economic oppression to have a different name. And it allows white people to think that they're better than other folks and that keeps them in many ways a victim of this economic system. So, you know, when I think about those things, I think about how, you know, we have to look at it from the standpoint of power. But yes, don't make it political.
Yeah, I love that. I love the idea that I love you saying that our best stories, our best plays have always been political. It's so validating for me to hear. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea of this theater company that you started too. I was just saying to my partner last night, we were watching Olympic highlights and it's so cliche, but I was like, you know what I think people like about the Olympics is this, it's one of the only televised events that everyone tunes in for where you really get to see that how absurd nationalism is and how similar we all are, that all of these people are just the same, that they all know the same rules to these games. They all have the same passion for these games. They all react the same way when they win, when they lose. They all have that same pride and drive. And it doesn't matter where they come from or, you know, what the temperature is like where they're from. Like it's a very interesting thing to watch and go, the only reason I'm cheering for the person with a certain flag is because they come from my place. But everyone in this race is the same. They're all very, they're similarly built. They have similar training. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's a very unifying look at the human species.
I think that you're right. I think it's competitive, but it's competing. It's really every person competing against themselves in a sort of way, right? Right. Uh-huh. And what just happened with Simone Biles and her dropping out, it's extraordinarily brave. In a way, it's her like her crowning achievement, right? This is the greatest gymnast who's ever lived, who's simply like, nah, I don't really want to do this right now. And there's something so extraordinary about that and amazing. You know, that this like walking away from competition, it's like one of those fantastic stories.
Yeah.
And saying like, there are other things that are more important than if I landed this jump on this day, you all know that I landed it yesterday. So who the fuck cares?
Right. You know?
But there's this celebration of humanity that's on display there. And we do love to compete. Humans love to compete. We're like great competitors, but I wish there was ways that we could compete with each other without it being, I mean, I guess the Olympics is a way to compete with each other without it being about life and death stakes, right? Because often when we're competing, we're killing each other, or we're competing for resources, we're competing for land. This is competing for like these sort of weird little trinkets that they put around a person's neck and say, well, you were the best, you know?
Yeah,
and all these people are the best in their own ways, right? But like, I mean, I guess I don't spend a lot of time watching the Olympics, but
I mean, certainly governments have an investment in being like, there is a nationalist aspect to it where it's like, we want the most medals and we want proof that our system is superior because look what our system bred the best athletes. There's that aspect to it, of course. But what I was seeing watching last night was I just was going, but look at all these people are all the same. They're not.
That's cool that you see it that way.
You know,
I mean, I haven't watched it in such a long time that I don't really know. But I interestingly, what we do in International WOW Company is that there are always groups of people who have completely different modes of expression. You know, and Western drama, American and European drama, has a different. Well, I can't say even American, European. American actors behave in certain ways that you could say that's how an American actor works. European, German actors, for example, behave in a certain way that you could learn something. And Thai actors work in a different way. And it's never about like, well, this is better than the other one. It's like, oh, that's a fascinating system that you use to perform that works in this way that I could learn from. And so for us, we're always about trying to learn and exchange from each other as much as we can be on an equal footing. And same thing with the documentaries that I make is like I'm interviewing and not actors this time, but I'm interviewing real people. Uh-huh. And they are real people as opposed to actors. actors are not real people. But, you know, like actors can be the realest of all people. But the idea that we are learning from each other and that we are part of a big puzzle, a big mosaic, and each of these stories is adding up to a different wrinkle of a much bigger story. That is something I think is really fascinating. And so, for example, like when we were making a play, we did a big cycle play, which never ever got finished because we could never find the funding, called Death of Nations. It was sort of like the a joke on Birth of a Nation, you know, the D.W. Griffith film that started Birth of a Nation being a really racist film about the Ku Klux Klan. Death of Nations was about how nationalism is declining and how we as a theater company wanted to focus on all the complex questions that happen when we do when globalization is happening. So we were talking about America, we're talking about Thailand, we're talking about Argentina, and we're talking about Iraq. We never got to finish the play, but what was fascinating about it was all the ways in which the performers were telling each other their stories, and the process of that made everybody just completely fall in love with each other. Mm-hmm. I don't mean like romantic love, like dating and like all that. I mean like falling in love in a community sense, in a deep bond type of a sense.
Yeah.
And watching these performers just have so much respect and love for each other because of their international cultural differences.
Yes.
Rather than what we see on television, you know, Donald Trump is saying, you know, Mexicans are all rapists, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And xenophobia and hatred based on nationalism. This was joy, sheer joy, and falling in love based on the differences between people. And I felt like that we held that up as an example of how we could be dealing with the very beautiful and amazing ways in which people are different. And, you know, I think we need to have different people. Like, and one of the consequences of globalization is that we're all on Instagram, we're all on Facebook, we all have all these experiences that create our brains in similar types of ways. Whereas in the past, our brains were created through different modes of communication and different languages. And one of the things that I really understand about what I think may have happened with Simone Biles and others is that Japan is a very difficult place to be.
Yeah.
As a Westerner, I had a rough time there. My first 6 months in Japan, I loved Japan. I loved it being there. I lived there on and off for 8 years. But my first 6 months there, I felt like the oddest, weirdest, most inappropriate, out of shape, out of place, out of time person.
Yeah.
And I broke out in hives over 60% of my body just in Tokyo. And those are the kinds of things that when you go to another country, some of them are really easy to go to. You know, it's really easy to go to Thailand. Thailand is an extraordinarily beautiful, nice place. Everyone is super nice. It's harder to go other places where it's harder to crack the code of what you're involved in and what's happening. And Tokyo is a place that can really exacerbate whatever mental crisis that you've had before you figure out how it works. It's very complicated. I'm not saying that was a factor. I just think it may have. It's not something that we understand. Like, you can't just exchange like Los Angeles for Tokyo, for London, for Athens actually understanding that these athletes are going to go through something in those places. And that the thing that we go through in Tokyo is going to be very, very different than the thing that we go through somewhere else, or in Beijing, for example,
in
for
Rio,
that matter. In Rio. Yeah. Like, there's a whole different feeling of what's permitted, what's not permitted. What you keep inside, what you can expose to the outside world. And Tokyo itself is an extraordinary, I have to say this, I love that place. Now, when I go there, I love it to death. It's one of my favorite places on the planet, but it took a really long time to understand it, or to feel like I could function in it in a way that was anywhere near functional. I wonder if that was a factor.
It possibly, you know, I mean, I talk to people sometimes about just, even I lived in New York City for 3 years, and people ask me where, if I prefer New York to LA. And I'm always like, I prefer LA. Just, I explain to them that New York is like you were saying about Tokyo, New York's a difficult place to live. And people who are born on the East Coast, like you, and people who are out there, you sort of grow up used to and used to the system, it's a difficult, place. And I respect the fact that different places have their different challenges, and that could absolutely be playing a role. I want to see if I can loop this all the way back around. We've been talking about just the beautiful differences of different cultures and the ways that you can highlight that with your theater company. I think all of this speaks to the fact that, you know, climate change and the climate crisis it's our problem to deal with as a human species. I'm going to try to make the route all the way back into this conversation.
Oh, absolutely. It's a very clear route for me. I mean, like, climate change is a problem we cannot solve alone as one nation. Climate change is a problem where we must come together as a human species to try to fix this. And that means that the primary countries that are causing climate change are the major industrialized nations.
Yeah.
United States, Europe, China, India. It's not Africa that's causing climate change.
Yeah.
It's not South America. It's not the Amazon causing climate change. Where are the emissions coming from and why? And that means we have to look at the global inequality. The Green New Deal, which is the solution to climate change, right? The Green New Deal.
Do you feel like the Green New Deal is a good thing? You feel like it's...
Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah. Let me just go back and say, so back in 2010, when we were fighting fracking, a bunch of us who were at the forefront of that movement, we decided that what we needed to do was create a 100% renewable energy plan for the state of New York, because we wanted to give that to Governor Cuomo and say, here we go. Here's your plan for 100% renewable energy. You do this instead of doing fracking. And that group of people was myself, Mark Ruffalo, Marco Crapels, who's a banker from California, and Mark Jacobson, a Stanford scientist. And the four of us founded a thing called the Solutions Project. And you can look online to see the Solutions Project. It's still there. The Solutions Project was about popularizing and implementing the idea of 100% renewable energy. So that is the technological basis of what the Green New Deal is about. But it goes much deeper than that. Because it's fundamentally, it has to be about justice.
Yeah,
it has to be about how do we create justice for frontline communities? How do we create racial justice as we implement a different system? Because the system of oil and gas and fossil fuels is a fundamentally exploitative, racist system that you cannot just simply say, oh, we're just going to replace the fuel. You have to come up with an entirely different set of parameters. So the Green New Deal is a technological idea. Based on how do we convert everything on the planet away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy to solve the climate crisis, which is fundamental, but it has to be about justice. The underpinnings of the idea is about justice. So I created a show last year called Staying Home with Josh Fox, Your Revolutionary Guide to the Green New Deal, which was on TYT, the Young Turks Network, which had 200 episodes during the lockdown of discussing with prominent climate scientists and cultural figures and musicians and people what they were doing during the lockdown, but also to talk about all the intersectional aspects of the Green New Deal. So the Green New Deal can't just be about like, we're going to continue the system that we're in of injustice. It can't be just like, all right, well, unplug the coal-fired power plant and plug in the wind turbines. That would not be fitting for the massive transformation that we need to have. The massive transformation we need to have has to be based on principles of justice and principles of resolving inequalities and environmental racism and environmental injustice that have been the hallmark of the environmental catastrophe that fossil fuels has wrought on the planet for more than 100 years, right? So fossil fuels currently, every year, kill 10 million people simply through pollution. Pollution kills... preventable deaths, 10 million people on the planet. Now, I believe, and I might be wrong about this, about 60 million people on the planet die every year. So that's like 1/6 of all the deaths on the planet are directly caused by the fossil fuel industry, which doesn't include the fact that fossil fuel related conditions also exacerbate deaths from the coronavirus. So the fossil fuel industry is actually a cofactor in the deaths of the coronavirus. Because if you live in a polluted area, you're more likely to die. You're more likely to get the coronavirus if you live in a polluted area. So, and the people who live in polluted areas are more often poor or black or brown communities, right?
Yeah.
People of color and poor people. So these things are all connected. So as we talk about the solutions to climate change, we not only talk about that from an American perspective, like let's say we have to look at Louisiana Cancer Alley, we have to look at West Virginia, we have to look at the communities that are suffering.
Yes.
But we also have to do that from a global perspective. So we have to take a look at the fact that America, being the rich nation, is causing the problem with all of the emissions. And each, you know, one Texan in terms of emissions is worth 1,000 kids in Africa in terms of emissions, because there's no, they're not emitting anything.
Yeah.
You know, we also have to look at that from the standpoint of the global inequalities that will emerge with climate change. If we say that we're going to cap climate change at 2 degrees, we're going to stop global warming at 2 degrees. Well, that cooks Africa by 4 degrees, because Africa cooks in terms of weather patterns, that will be the result. So it cannot just be about like, our first world nations are going to solve their emissions problems, it has to also look into the fact that we need climate reparations. We need status for climate change refugees in the same way that you should be ask for asylum if based on your identity. You should be able to ask for asylum based on climate change. And yet we have Kamala Harris outrageously going to Guatemala, a country that is suffering huge droughts and floods and climate catastrophe where people can't actually have food because of the climate crisis. And Kamala Harris saying to Guatemalans, don't come to America. Don't come here. It's like, no, that is unbelievably unbelievable to me, because it should be, yes, come here if you have to. And also we should be sending you billions and billions and billions of dollars in aid to keep your society afloat, because our emissions have destroyed your farms.
Yeah.
There's a global system of justice and responsibility. So what we have to do is not just say all of these nations have to decarbonize, because certainly some of those nations need to develop to keep their population, to raise the standard of living of their populations. But it has to be a global effort to towards justice. And the calling of the planet to us is to say that your systems over the last 500 years have been unjust, and those systems have to change. And if you don't change towards systems that are more just in the process of decarbonizing, you're, by the way, it's not going to work. You're not going to be able to decarbonize in that situation. And it's going to cause, you're going to have massive upheaval, and you may end up just exiting the planet as a species altogether. So this is a giant challenge that we are being faced with. And I don't know with the outcome. I don't know if we're going to succeed. I don't know if we're going to fail. We're certainly failing right now. But the parameters of the discussion have to be about justice, which is one of the wonderful things that the Green New Deal is really focused on. That the Green New Deal is a little bit poisoned right now. The idea of it, the people have been, you know, using it as a bad terminology, but the basic idea that we need to have sustainability on this planet, and that's based in justice and it's based in green technology, meaning solar and wind, that is the solution to climate change. And it has to be.
Yeah. Once again, we see the politicization of something that shouldn't be. The only reason it's this, it's the successful gaslighting from the opposers of this movement, who make it sound like a bad word and do what they do. Right. And it's just stuff that it's like, well, obviously this is something that needs to happen if we're going to have a shot at surviving as a species. Now, this topic, as we wind down here, this topic can be so depressingly bleak when you really, really dare to look into it and dare to, you know, take even the slightest peek into it. It just feels like way too little too late, and like whatever we need to do, we needed to do it 20 years ago. And it can feel so overwhelmingly gargantuan as a task. In your mind, what's it going to take? Because even everything you're talking about right now, it's like, well, we need overwhelming support that we don't have right now for these things to take effect. And what's it going to take to get us there? I did an episode on my podcast about this recently where I was like, I hypothesized that I said, you know, like you just said, 10 million people a year die from climate change. 4 million people just died from the coronavirus. Apparently that's not enough pain. That's not enough pain to get for people to move. So what amount of pain? I've theorized that it takes a catastrophe on the level where like a few billion die, where not the entire species dies, but could something happen that breaks down society to a point where we have a true catastrophe where it looks like we're really seeing that it's like almost one in three people are dying.
But I don't know that that's what does it. Actually, I have to say that I think what I've watched in terms of successful political movements, successful activist movements, is that when you have a sense of people working together, and you have a sense of working together community, and you have a sense that we're on the verge of being able to win. My film, and I would love everybody to watch the film, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change, because it's essentially about climate despair. What you're talking about is climate despair. Climate despair is a very rough thing to undertake. In the same way that it is to despair about any other political situation, but like climate despair is rough. It puts you down. And if you're depressed, you can't do anything. If you're not feeling good, you can't do anything. If you're feeling anxious, you can't do anything. If you're in a state of fear and anxiety and loathing and depression, you can't do anything.
Yeah.
And so I made this movie, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change, to try to address climate despair. And that project has turned into our platform that we're launching. We launched 4 days ago.
Yeah, I want to know more about this too.
It's called Climate Revolution. And you can watch all of my films there for free, including this film, How to Let Go of the World. And Climate Revolution is the 12-hour version of that film. That film was 2 hours. It premiered at Sundance. It was on HBO. But the film was always intended to be 12 hours. So the 12-hour version is called Climate Revolution or How to Let Go of the World and Level of Things Climate Can't Change. And we're putting out piece by piece. And these are stories of people who are fighting, who've been to that moment of despair, who see the writing on the wall and who get up every day and keep working on it.
Yeah.
And because I needed to do that for my own sense of inspiration, like to go, how do we keep doing this? How do you keep doing this? So these are environmental monitors in the Amazon who are going and investigating oil spills deep, deep, deep into the jungle to get the story out. These are political dissidents in China who are speaking out in spite of the fact that they could have incredible consequences. These are the stories where we realize that we don't save the world all at once, but every day. Every day is the practice, and every day is the journey. And it's about making life worth living. And if you're not living in a meaningful way, if you're stuck in a dead end job, 40% of Americans right now want to quit their job.
Yeah.
40% of Americans want to quit their job. We are seeing the disintegration of the American dream. We are seeing the fact that that is emptying out, bottoming out. Nobody wants it. It is not where we're at. We have to find a way of living more meaningfully. So Climate Revolution is two things. It's a platform of those inspiring stories, but it's also going to get people activated by publishing the actions of the week, all the things that are happening across the country, across the world, that people can participate to work within the climate movement. Because the antidote to that kind of despair, it's not how bad is it going to get. It gets worse. We feel worse. We get pummeled into submission. Mm. It's about us understanding that we can fight back, and that fighting back is not just arduous. It's not like taking your medicine. It's really fun. I mean, this podcast is part of that. Yeah. The work that I do. I mean, everyone, when you get into that movement in one way or another, and what I mean by that is, you know, that old saw, which is so true, think globally, act locally. When you get into it with your people, you're gonna find the most important relationships you've ever had in your life. You're gonna find the best friendships you've ever had in your life because you're working with people on things that are meaningful. I think I take this from the theater. When we're in the theater together, we're in life or death stakes. You know, you have to trust the people you're on stage with.
Yeah.
If you don't trust them, something really bad could happen. You could fall off the stage. The light could fall on your head. You could end up in a very emotionally dangerous situation. And that's the same thing when you're fighting climate change. There is a need for more and more and more local organizing. When we organize, meaning when we come together and we say, who has this skill, who has that skill, who can contribute this, who can contribute that, that is a process that's very natural to us as humans. I think it's unnatural for us to live in these nuclear families of five people competing against each other, blah, blah, blah. We are programmed somewhere deep, deep in our past to live in groups of 150 people. And when you have an organization that's 10 people, that's 20 people, that's 30 people, that's working together to create actions, to create motion, there's this something that locks into place that you feel like, oh, this is my job on the planet. My job on the planet is not to create widgets for Amazon. My job on the planet is actually to make sure that that life continues. So when we do that, and we do that with a group of people en masse, there is something that is so fulfilling. So I would encourage people to go to this Climate Revolution platform. You can find it on my Instagram. My Instagram is joshfoxfilm.com. The actual site is josh-fox.ghost.io. It's and you can get all of our content there for free. the free subscription is exactly the same as the paid subscription. We're asking people to donate $5 a month to us because we want that, but we don't want to put everything behind a paywall, you know.
I love that.
It's $5 a month if you want it to be, which we need for sure.
If you can make the movies, we need
the money to keep making the work.
Yeah.
But the idea that this is our gift to humanity, but it's also a place where you can become active, where you can find the actions that are happening all around you, and that you can start to figure out how to interact with that system of the movement that's in place, because I think that's our only hope. Obi-Wan Kenobi, that is our only hope, is people getting activated and not doing it thinking, I as one person have to save the world. No, you just have to jump in and be involved with the thing. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. This is happening all over the country. It's happening all over the world. There are people involved and invested. And I hope that our movement welcomes new folks with open arms as much as possible. And that is a thing that is a journey all of its own. But take this first step, you know, show up at the organizing meeting, show up at the protest, show up at the campaign, find your way of interacting with that. And then I think we're on the right road, you know.
Well, Josh, you've helped today to quell some of my climate despair with that last piece there. I genuinely, it's nice to hear a more uptick view than the one that I tend to offer sometimes to my listeners. And I hope that there are people who are listening who also feel like their climate despair has maybe been lifted a tad. And hopefully their interest is
peaked. It's an everyday thing, though.
Yeah.
It's an everyday thing.
Yep.
So that's why we're doing this. We're putting out new videos every couple of days.
Yeah, I hope that they go check it out, Climate Revolution, and and go watch the movie that you made as well. You've been doing such incredible work and devoting your life and your time and your artistic sensibilities to really, really important stuff. And I agree with you that it's the big issues that tend to make the most lasting impact as stories, and that are the most important stories. And so just thank you for everything that you're doing. And thanks for giving me a much needed shot in the arm.
Well, thank you for your brilliant, hilarious stuff. I really enjoyed it, and I would love to, tell me how to publicize the podcast and send me all the information. And
oh, sure.
Everyone should just go to my Instagram or my Twitter, and they'll see stuff about how to sign up for our latest thing. But the whole idea is to try to cheer people up, because try to make sure that the realities of the difficulty of the situation aren't so daunting that you just like stay home and don't do anything. The realities of the situation should be motivational for us in some way, but I don't know that motivates people. I think what motivates people is like, they want to meet new friends. They want to go out and have fun with folks. And that's what I think this can be. As desperate and fucked up and sad and weird and not our fault this whole thing is.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, cool. It's good stuff.
Thanks, Austin.
Yeah.
Great to meet you.
Great to meet you as well. I hope we chat soon.
All right.
Okay. Thanks, Josh.
Take it easy.
All right, that's Josh Fox. His new platform is called Climate Revolution, and it's a fantastic platform. It's free. You can pay them if you can afford it and if you want to, and you should. You should support them, but it's free. They're putting it out there for free access. It's full of content, shows, series, documentaries, movies about the climate crisis, and he's gone from making an Academy Award nominated documentary to a full-blown platform full of content about this stuff. You should really check him out. Josh Fox Film on Instagram, and look up Climate Revolution, the platform, the content platform. It's free. If you don't have the money for another platform, for another subscription right now, you can go and watch it for free and get the information. Then if you're watching and you're like, damn, I like this stuff, and you want to support it monetarily, you can and probably should do that too. So go check that out. Let's head over to TikTok. We're on TikTok right now. We're live on TikTok. We're doing the TikTalk. We're chit-chatting with our friends over on TikTok. What do you all think about this, TikTok? What do you think about the climate crisis? How do you feel when you see videos like the one that I described in the intro. You know, I mean, I was watching that video and it was crazy. It looked like a giant snake was like slithering by the window of this boat. And it was just like wreathed in flame. I couldn't make sense of what I was looking at. And then I realized, oh, it was, it's just a place that's on fire, you know, and people are being evacuated on a boat. It looked like a movie, but it wasn't. Unnecessary Robot says despair. Yeah, I relate to that. Definitely relate to that. Xuzi says, I live in a small seaside town. Fires get closer each year. That video is horrifying. I saw a tweet the other day that said something like, the way that most of us in the modern world are going to experience the climate crisis is through cell phone videos until slowly but surely it becomes us. We become the person who's shooting the video. So you're just going to watch one after another until at some point you're the person who's filming the video, who's standing in the place, just like you're talking about with the fires getting closer and closer to your town. Every year we're hitting record heat in the summer, and every year the fire season seems to be another record worst fire season ever. Definitely can contribute to that feeling of despair. Michael Kalin says, makes me not want to have kids at all. Yeah, I relate to that too. That's why I think that, you know, Mike Judge's movie Idiocracy gets more and more relevant every year, because I think there's all kinds of things like this that cause socially progressive and more liberal minded people to think like, oh, it's socially irresponsible to have kids, or at least to have like 4 or 5 or 6 kids. Like, maybe I could justify 1 or 2, but like, I don't know if I can responsibly bring someone into this world without a guarantee that it's going to be here for another 20 or 30 years. Or at least not going to, you know, like if I do bring a child into the world right now, what are they going to have to deal with, as a result of climate change almost from birth? You know, kids are already having to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic, which is an effect of climate change. I relate to that feeling. It's a hard thing to reckon with. Like, can I responsibly bring someone into this? But then the other thing is like, if I don't do that, and it's only the irresponsible people and the irresponsible households that are having kids, do we wind up with Idiocracy, with Mike Judge's movie? Will it just be only the stupid people who are reproducing? Like, do the Josh Foxes of the world need to be reproducing so that we can have soldiers in the future to fight the climate crisis, and to, you know, people who are teaching that science is real in their households, and raising kids to believe scientists and not to be skeptical of anything that doesn't go against a thousands-year-old book of myths. Perkabeth says, it feels like we've been kept ignorant of the problem until it's too big to be ignored. Sort of, but also not. I don't think anyone's been made have. Now, look, there's definitely efforts being made by the fossil fuels industry and by, yeah, you know, like, there's definitely people with money and with a vested interest in keeping us uninformed and in mixing up the waters of like, how do we discern what information is good information and bad information? There's definitely people who have a vested interest in at least creating the idea that all of the facts that are coming out about climate change can be questioned and should be, you should be skeptical about them and stuff. That's definitely a thing. But I think that the people who, the scientists, and a lot of socially responsible world leaders and organizations have been trying for decades now to inform us and to let us know about the problem. So I know that it can feel like, how come I'm just hearing about this now? But they've definitely been trying to tell us for about 40 or 50 years now. It's now really getting to the point that they were all warning us about 40 or 50 years ago. We're seeing all of this stuff come to fruition in real time. And so it's becoming more and more acute, and it's feeling like, oh, well, now everyone cares and it's too late now. But here's the thing, is it's not actually too late. That here's the thing about the despair that everyone feels and stuff, is like, talking with Josh and talking with people who are really involved in this fight, they're actually more optimistic than most other people because they know that that real practical things can be done to affect change. Alien Country Movie says, everyone follow Alien Country Movie. We love them. And go listen to the episode Making Movies with Boston and Rennie on the People Pleaser podcast. They're fantastic. Alien Country Movie says, I love that Josh Fox is doing something, solving it in his industry. Every industry needs to do more. Yeah, it's definitely an issue of industries, over individuals for sure. There's a lot of narratives that talk about just sort of like individual footprint and what you can do to reduce your individual carbon footprint and not using plastic straws and trying to cut down on your share of the garbage that goes in the ocean and maybe getting an electric car and all that stuff. But really, at the end of the day, it's a handful of industries that need to overhaul the infrastructure of how they produce the products that they make and how they basically do everything. They kind of need to rebuild from the ground up. And what needs to happen for that to happen is there needs to be some kind of financial safety net that assures them that, hey, don't worry, we will pay for the rebuild. And so people like Bill Gates, who seems to be, at least on paper, interested in this problem, but people like Bill Gates and the Elon Musks of the world and the Jeff Bezoses of the world, instead of building dick rockets and going to space and having space competitions, they need to be putting their money into fixing Earth's problems, not trying to escape Earth and get to Mars. They need to be putting their money into helping those industries rebuild, saying we will cover the cost of helping your industry rebuild so that everything that you're producing is it's being done in a green way and in a sustainable way that helps us have a better future and hopefully cuts down on emissions and everything like that. Because at the end of the day, like each individual person and what the amount we're contributing versus the amount that the industries are contributing is it's like a drop versus the entire ocean. So, you know, it's like, watch the movie Seaspiracy on Netflix, and it will talk to you about how, like, yeah, humans need to stop throwing garbage into the ocean when they're at the beach, like, for sure. Don't throw garbage onto the beach and don't throw your garbage off of a boat or into the water. But the biggest polluters of the ocean by far, and the biggest, like, problem facing the ocean is the fishing industry by far. And that's, you know, that's an industry problem. So Xsuzy says, I live in Alaska. Our economy is oil based. It's overwhelmingly depressing here. Yeah, I imagine it is. And that's the thing I think is the discomfort that people imagine when they think about losing a major swath of a huge industry like that, or a major swath of the economy. They think about losing jobs. They think about, you know, like, how are we just going to replace stuff overnight? And I'm not sure. I'm not the guy that's got the plan mapped out. I'll just tell you right now, friends. But I know that anything is better than nothing. That taking moves, like making moves, making plans, putting things into action instead of just doing what so often happens, which is just sort of like twiddling thumbs and sweeping stuff under the rug and sort of hand-wringing and having debates in Congress, that's not actually going to get it done. It's Quell says, the Caribbean and coastal cities and areas will suffer if this goes downhill. I'm terrified of that. I mean, yeah. Yeah. It almost feels inevitable. It almost feels like there's no avoiding it. I kind of pitched my doomsday scenario to Josh. I was like, here's my theory is like, it's going to have to get so bad that it's going to be a crisis on the level of billions of people dying before anyone really gets it and does enough to actually seriously change. And I was like, what do you think about that? Do you think I'm onto something there? Do you think it'll take that level of pain? And he had a much more optimistic view than I did. You know, obviously if you're listening to this on the podcast, you already know what he said, but everyone here on TikTok doesn't know, and you should check it out on Thursday and go check out his platform. It was refreshing to hear someone who's been a little bit more hands-on in the fight have a more optimistic view and a feeling that we actually can fight back. Mostly what he said was just individuals need to accept that you it's okay to get involved. Don't be overwhelmed by the gargantuan nature of the task. That giant fire monster that I thought I saw at the beginning of the video, don't be scared off by that. Get involved in ways that you can. It's that whole think globally, act locally mindset, you know? Embrace that mindset that, like, you're not going to be able to solve all of the world's problems and single-handedly overturn the practices of all these major industries, but see what you can do. See how you can get involved in your community. See how you can get involved in helping out the efforts that are going on in your local neighborhood, because almost definitely there's something in your local area that is centered around this fight, and you can figure out a way to get involved, whether it's donating to them, whether it's volunteering with them, whether it's if you're a person with a platform, helping them boost their signal, get the word out, whatever you can do to get involved. And don't make the task this big, overwhelming, depressing task. You know, see if there's a way that you can break it down into manageable things where you can go, I know what I can do. I can go over and see if I can volunteer one day a month over at this organization that's helping spread awareness about whatever, you know. I'm gonna go get involved with the line 3 water protectors, and I'm gonna make sure I spread awareness about that. By the way, stop line 3, and check out, if you don't know about line 3, look up what's going on with line 3 and the water protectors right now. Figuring out ways that you can get involved on a practical basis and trying to get involved in that headspace and that sort of work without getting bogged down by the idea that it's overwhelming or it's too much. Because I think that collectively is what's dooming us as a collective species, is sort of this fatigue of the overwhelming nature of the task, feeling like it's just too big, it's too much of a task, I can't possibly attack it on my own. Hi from Swaziland in Southern Africa. Wow, amazing. Hi, how are you? Amazing. Swaziland. Wow. Incredible. Y'all want to hear me sing all of the countries in Africa? I was thinking about this. I was watching the Olympics the other day, and I was thinking that I still know all of this whole song. In eighth grade for geography, we had to memorize how to draw the entire African continent and all of the countries in it. And I, to this day, I'm like, I can't think of like why they made us do that. Like, what is the practical purpose of that? And I guess it's just like to just enhance your awareness of the world around you and how big and diverse of a place it really is. I'm not sure what the practical use is, but I still know. And then when I see these countries like participating in the Olympics, I'm like, oh, I know where that is. I know like where in the African continent that is. Here's the song. I'll do the song for you really quick. It goes, Cape Verde, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Sudan and Chad and Niger, Mali, Mauritania, Senegal, Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Ivory Coast, Burkina Faso, Ghana and Togo, something, Nigeria, South Africa, Lesotho and Swaziland, Madagascar, Comoros, Seychelles, and Mauritius. Africa's a great big place. So, all right, y'all. Well, I'm gonna wrap up the podcast, but still hang out. I'll stay on and chat a little while longer. Thanks for the comments, and thanks again to my guest Josh Fox. He was fantastic. Go follow him at Josh Fox Film on Instagram and I think Twitter. And go check out the new platform. It's free. Go check it out. Go watch his movie Gaslamped, his Academy Award nominated movie. And see what you can do to get involved locally in the local climate change fight near you. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com, where my new album is out. You guys, thanks so much again for buying my album, everyone who did so far. And if you haven't, you still can. It's still available. It's still there. austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. Now that's what I call a bunch of Austin Archer's TikTok songs compiled into an album. Volume 2 is available right now. Go check it out. It was mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn, who mixes and and masters this show, Chris Bjorn over at Marmalade Music. We love him. He's the best in the biz. Go to themarmalademusic.com and tell Chris that you heard his work on People Pleaser, and he'll give you 20% off of your first audio project. Themarmalademusic.com. Tell Chris that I sent you. Okay, all right. Be good to each other. See how you can get involved in the climate fight in your neighborhood, and we'll talk to you next week. I love you. Bye-bye.